Welcome to Homepage Radio. I'm Duo Dickinson. I'm an architect and I write some. And I talk every month here in WPKN Radio, 89.5 FM on your dial. I talk every month about something that is not talked about enough, which is domestic realities. Not highfalutin architecture, not aesthetics, not how to screw in your wreath at Christmas time, but really about the fact that our homes are our most intimate and most public, most loving and most threatening, most publicly exposing and most privately embracing things in our lives. In this episode, and I'm joined today by radio mime Rod Richardson, who is actually the silent sentinel of radio uplift and support today, since he is essentially voiceless. But he is here with me in studio to create something that is uniquely present in our world at this moment, at this quote-unquote Christmas week moment between... I would say in the middle of Kwanzaa, in after Hanukkah, after Christmas, before New Year's, somewhere in Festivus. I'm not really sure where Festivus comes in all of this. Eid, I think, is next month. I'm not sure, but my guest in studio, Richard Romano, will confirm this. But we are in this weird winter solstice period where, because of ancient terror over the losing of light and ancient thrill over the gaining of light, this moment in the Earth's rotation around the sun, tilted at a strange angle, this instant has forced humans to confront time, to confront an annualization of our expectations, a yearly assessment of our joys, our sorrows. Maybe for people that are of a certain generation, the metronome of the fact that we might be on the return boat ride home, we're past the midpoint, we're in the long final last act of our lives. We are being measured essentially by the season. The season is something which has real implications to our day-to-day lives, but maybe the most tangible and actually most impactive lessons and consequences to our homes. Our homes are stressed and changed in this month, typically the month of December, maybe January, this solstice time of year. Our homes are stressed like you wouldn't believe. In the Northeast, we have to go inside, so we don't have any outside pressure relief. We can't go to our sunrooms. We can't go to our screen porches. We can't have a party or a dinner on our deck. It's freezing. The weather's terrible. It's dark, and we are brought inside with artificial light to do what? Well, for some people, it's to gnarl out and feel bad about themselves. But for most people, it's to convene and to bring together people that normally don't see each other. I call this the festive home. And this month's episode of Homepage Radio is about the fact that homes have an infinite number of identities. For many people, every night it becomes the intimate place of our bed. For other people, it becomes the setting and focal point perch of our morning breakfast assault on the world. Other people, our homes are the place that is the safe harbor that we come home to and feel embraced and settled in a sea of controversy or unsureness or fear. For other people, the home is essentially a wonderful place of family. Well, in the Christian tradition, you know, there is a manger. There's a home for animals that becomes the home for what is, in theory, the savior of the universe, God incarnate, this Advent thing where essentially a home is made out of a unheated, unfinished barn. And the most precious thing in the world, your baby, is in the trough where you slop the hogs. It's in a manger where animals eat. And that high brought low, or low brought high, or whatever you want to call it, that nature of coming together, of the three kings coming into your house, or dancing around the Festivus pole while everybody watches, or feats of strength, or whatever is part of your life at this solstice time, means more people come into your home to do more things. There are parties. There are exchanges of gifts. For some people, they kill a tree, bring it in, electrify it, throw ornaments on it. They create these weird rituals, or they recreate these weird rituals that our homes serve as the embrace of. They are the stage set through which all of these weird annualized things happen. And our culture even embraces it. Guilford, Connecticut, for example, imposes on every single house around the green of Guilford, Connecticut, they install a wreath mandatorily on each house because it is the Christmas season and we must be a Currier and Ives painting. And that cultural embrace is one of the reasons why I have in here one of my great good friends, Richard Mamana. Richard Mamana has many different roles in life. He's an associate for ecumenical and interreligious relation. He has works for, and that's the Episcopal Church in the USA, right?
That's correct.
And then you also do sometimes translation for the United Nations.
I have done some translation at the UN Commission on the Status of Women. That's true.
And you have also, tell me really quickly for the radio audience, you have this incredible project involving, I guess I'd call it Anglican history. What is that?
It's anglicanhistory.org. It's called Project Canterbury. It's a free online library of historical documents and out-of-print books related to the history of the Episcopal Church and the Church of England, the Anglican Church in Canada, and all around the world.
And so here's the funny thing. So I've got this incredibly great intellectual human with an enormous legacy, both in Pennsylvania and in Japan, bizarrely enough, and also two young children. I brought Richard here not for those reasons, but because I think, unique among people that I know, Richard has a sensibility about celebration and festivities, not only at home, but also in the workplace and also around. So we're going to be talking to Richard. We're also going to be talking to William Hosley, who is actually created something called Terra Firma Northeast, which is a place that really celebrates New England architecture. And then later we'll be talking to Karen B. Davis, who is a photographer who has a brand new book out called A Connecticut Christmas. And she, in that book, visually explicates this enormous desire we have to create a festive home. So that's our 55 minutes today. It's in the middle of a 6-week period where people feel more exuberant and more threatened than they feel at any other time of the year. And at Homepage, we're here to have you listen both live right now on the radio, but also as a podcast. We are here at WPKN so that you can hear what other people think actually about your home. So join us in a little bit, and we will have William Hosley with us. Well, today on Homepage Radio, we're focusing on the festive home. This is the season, as we say, where there is Festivus, there is Eid coming up, we are in the middle of Kwanzaa, we are in Advent, we have the New Year right around the corner of the show. And with us amidst this period of winter solstice, I keep wanting to say summer solstice, is William Hosley. William Hosley is the principal of Terra Firma Northeast, which is a cultural resource development and marketing place for him. He is a new media expert, a historian, and a museologist. I think it means museumologist, preservationist. But more important to me, because he's worked with landmarks commissions and he was the director of the New Haven Museum and all this. Bill, I have to tell you, you are to me the single most comprehensive, understander of architecture in the life of people in New England. Is that a fair statement?
Well, I wouldn't go that far, but I know a lot about Connecticut and I'm traveled all through New England and New York. So, yeah, I've poked around, and I certainly have been a fanatical shutterbug photographing historic architecture since I was a teenager. And I'm getting old, so I've done a lot of that.
Well, I already am old, so I beat you there. let me ask you a question, and I want, because I really value what your thoughts are, and I think I sent you this question a while ago, and I really would love to hear your comprehensive answer on this one. How do you think homes have evolved over since the colonists came to Connecticut, or really New England? How have homes evolved in embracing coming together in these 300 or 400 years?
Well, I have a program I do where I try to condense 350 years of Connecticut home living, domestic architecture, yes, into a short program. And there's a great early illustration, whether it's perfectly accurate or not, I don't completely know, but shows, you know, the Puritans and on the Quinnipiac River in the 1630s, essentially living in teepees. And so right. It was pretty harsh. And not many people, you know, lived in very small houses. And if there is one theme that continues through the 300 plus years, it's, you know, ever larger, for better or for worse. People live now sometimes in these sprawling mansions, which would have been unimaginable in the 18th century. But, you know, the architecture, it developed greater complexity and greater comfort and greater room use specialization, all kinds of things. And I think with a lot of the images we have of home and hearth and family life are shaped by the Victorian age, which really represented a watershed in terms of comfort and domestic amenities.
How is that reflected in the way people celebrated that change from tiny houses to more complex and larger houses? How do you think the way people celebrated changed?
Well, I think if you have, when you have bigger rooms and more space and specialized rooms, you know, like the parlor, even in the 18th century, was a not that commonly used room. And people talk about the so-called funeral doors on the early houses. And you don't think of funerals necessarily as celebrations, but they actually were. And they were so frequent that it was a time that people stopped their labor, came together, and socialized, and you know, broke bread and reflected on the fragility of life and reflected on loved ones past. And those funerals happened at home. Yeah. There were no funeral parlors. There was no industry.
Wow.
People dressed their dead. And there's some wonderful firsthand recollections. People would write about funerals they attended. So they're really quite interesting in capturing a sense of, I guess you could call it the social or even festive aspect of it. Of course, Christmas, the Episcopalians brought Christmas to New England, and it was very controversial at first. And there were great stories of Congregationalists kind of sneaking out of their Puritan confines to peek in over the transom and see what the Episcopalians were doing with their Christmas trees. And that was sort of in the 1820s and 30s. And it took by the 1840s and 50s, Christmas was a established holiday. And I'm sure, you know, there had always been traditions of harvest festivals and people, yes, breaking in the transition for seasons. But Christmas, as you know, was not a Puritan holiday. The birth of Christ was not really celebrated.
Right.
And so
and it's not even really his birthday anyway. So, what's the point?
Right. So we can live with that. But,
I'm joining the studio, Bill, by Richard Mamana. And Richard is a card carrying Episcopalian. And I would love to have Richard chime in on this aspect, really, of the popularization of Christmas in New England, which I perceive to be directly related to Tiny Tim and the popular novels of the time. And why don't you, Richard, tell me what you think of this period of time?
Well, Bill's exactly right. So celebrating Christmas would have been illegal in the early Puritan colonies. In Plymouth, for example, Bradford is horribly incensed that people don't want to work on Christmas Day. And the laws against celebrating the sort of papist Romish holiday weren't repealed until would have been Christmas 1681. And the picture of the New England Christmas that we have now is really a product of, exactly as Bill said, the early 19th century. So, you know, a visit from St. Nicholas, which was written by my distant cousin Clement Clark Moore, wasn't published until 1823. And Dickens' Christmas Carol is 1843. And the sort of domestic use of Christmas trees, my hometown, Easton, Pennsylvania, claims that it had the first Christmas tree in America.
Really?
There's no evidence for it. but there's a marker on the green down by the Delaware River that says we're the home of America's first Christmas tree in 1816.
Wow.
So that's that stream of Christmas celebration is part of a very immigrant culture, the German culture. German Catholics would have brought a lot of what we consider modern American Christmas in the 1830s and 1840s. It's no mistake that Pennsylvania makes these claims with, you know, towns called Bethlehem and Nazareth that are right next to each other.
There you go.
Richard, you'll love this. If I understand this correctly, the first Catholic Mass ever preached in Connecticut was along the what is now the Windsor Locks Canal, because the Irish, it was one of the first settlements of Irish, and they helped build this canal in the 1820s. And there was apparently a Christmas tree that they used. And and it was so foreign and mysterious to the residents of Connecticut at that time that it made news.
Wow. You know, I was going to ask you a very simple question. You had mentioned the funerals being celebrations, which I totally buy. Do you think that in this puritanical, and I mean that in the historic sense, not in a judgmental sense, this puritanical culture, do you think the absolute adherence to the Sabbath, where essentially activity stopped and the meal was extremely important after a 3 or 4 hour service, do you think that weekly cessation of labor was in effect a celebration? Did you think the home transformed on Sunday, or if it was Saturday, but I'm assuming Sunday, did that Sabbath change the way the home was used?
Well, I don't know about the home, but I mean, people left the home to go to church.
Church,
they
yep.
had these they called them Sabbath day houses because there were services in the morning and the afternoon, and you would spend almost, depended on the circumstances, but you could spend almost all day.
I didn't know
in
that
church-related activities, and they, you know, because they, it always astonishes me when you look here in Connecticut at some of the geography of these early towns, like Windsor, Connecticut, included East Windsor. And if you know that area today, it ain't so easy to get from East Windsor to Windsor, even with a car. And if you think about the First Church of Windsor being on the other side of the river in midwinter, wow. I mean, you know, how did they get there? And if they were if they traveled that far, what did they? You know, it wasn't for an in and out 1 hour service.
No.
They were spending most of the day, and I think part of that was social, and social almost inevitably means celebratory to some
yes.
degree.
So in your final couple of minutes with us, I'd love to hear, because you've got probably the best perspective of anybody I know, how do you celebrate these holidays? Do you create rituals? How does your home change during the holidays?
Well, it's a bad time to ask, because we're literally in the midst of tearing up our 1833 farmhouse to
right.
replace our 19th century heating system, which we heat the house with wood and coal, and we're finally doing this very invasive for natural gas. So the first year of my life, we haven't had a tree and decorations
for wow.
the places. But yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, visiting relatives, it's there's something I love going out at night and seeing the lights that people do and just traveling around and looking, sort of peering through the windows. It's a little bit of voyeurism, but people obviously are doing this for show. And, you know, it's lovely seeing people sort of evoke a sense of, again, hearth and home through their festive decorations and enjoyment of the season. And it's particularly nice when it snows.
Well, Bill, I can't thank you enough for being here. I think your life's work of showing the world what the transition of time was, especially in Connecticut through the centuries, is invaluable. And I really appreciate you being on the show.
Well, thank you, and best wishes to all for a lovely Christmas season.
Thank you so much. When we come back on Homepage Radio, we're going to be talking to Karen B. Davis, who is a photographer who's just come out with a book by Globe Pequot Press called A Connecticut Christmas, which has in its pages some amazing homes with incredible transformative decorations. But before that, I would love, Richard, you've got this wonderful sense. I'm going to give you a tradition that we had in my home that I actually do think you might relate to. So before I was born, my parents were late parents of children and were fairly prototypic suburbanites coming out of New York City in 1952. They would not put a single Christmas decoration up, not one anything, send the kids to bed on December 24th. And then once the kids were asleep, they would pull the tree out from behind other trees and decorate and wrap and put all the presents out so that by the time the kids woke up, they had not slept. And there was this wild, intense relief of pressure as the kids had the magic Santa Claus brings the tree down the chimney. Did you have anything like that growing up?
We did, and I still try to buy a tree as late in the month as I can. I still don't have one on December 22nd. I've noticed, though, that it becomes difficult to buy a tree.
Yes.
The later in the month you get, because people have started putting up their trees around Thanksgiving in some cases. But I still buy a tree on the 23rd or 24th, and it's my family tradition to decorate it on the 24th in the evening, and then before church. And then we go to church, and we're allowed to open one present when we come back. And then, of course, there's a lot more under the tree in the morning. Yeah.
Well, having said that, we're going to be talking to Karen B. Davis about A Connecticut Christmas when we return to Homepage Radio on WPKN 89.5 FM on your dial and live streaming. Welcome back to Homepage Radio. This month on Homepage Radio, we're talking about the festive home. We are right in the middle of a very strange time of year, the time of extreme pressure, depressure, of extreme transformation of our homes, of our lives, to essentially go from a workaday normative state for 11 months a year to about a month of time where human beings gather and come together. When the weather is pretty terrible, there's no outside aspects, there's no covered sunrooms or porches to inhabit, there are no barbecues, we come into homes that in theory are responding to the fact that families gather, people gather, the culture celebrates something that was essentially formed thousands of years ago for the summer solstice, and really maybe 150 or 200 years ago was actually celebrated in the Western world, really because of the Episcopal Church, according to our recent guest, Bill Hosley, and my in-studio cohabitant, Richard Mamana, talking about the fact that Christmas as a religious holiday has severe and amazing domestic realities in New Haven, but also in Connecticut in general, but also the entire season that involves Kwanzaa, Eid coming up, Festivus, Hanukkah, all of these things, plus New Year's, which you're going to be celebrating almost instantly, New Year's, we have taken our homes and we have transformed them in hope and in celebration and in enormous ritualistic ornamentation. And in that tradition of ritualistic ornamentation, in Connecticut, in the belly of New England, Karen B. Davis, a photographer, has created a book for Globe Pequot Press called A Connecticut Christmas. Eric Lehman did the writing for this, but Karen B. Davis, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I think it's an amazing thing that in the 200 pages of your book, I'm assuming you must have 300 or 400 photographs.
There's just about, I think, 420 in there.
Wow. Wow. And one is more interesting than the other. And as a photographer, human being to myself, I am extremely grateful for the fact there's almost no evident artificial light. It looks all naturally lit to me, but that's because I'm stupid. But the truth is, I look through this incredible book, A Christmas in New England. Sorry, oh, that's a lie. It is I got to get it right, A Connecticut Christmas, because you got to order it. A Connecticut Christmas. I see these incredibly over-the-top decorated places, mostly historicist. And I'm wondering, how long did it take you to make this happen?
Well, I photographed for about 2 seasons, and the first season, 6 weeks, and the second season, about 9 weeks, because I was able to eke out just a little extra after New Year's. There were still some decorations that were up, including the cover shot, which I got after New Year's because it had snowed and the lights were still there. So that was a good thing.
And you've got different houses. I think you've got the Mark Twain house, the Howard house. Tell us about some of the Phelps Hathaway house and garden. Tell us about some of the houses and what they do and how many of them were public and how many of them were private.
Well, I photographed two private homes. One was a 1760s house in Woodstock that eventually became an inn during the Revolutionary War. And the owners of that, they kept the entire decorations in the period of the house, very traditional. So they had a lot of pineapples in wreaths and pineapples on top of the mantle over the fireplace and cranberries strung on strings and dried fruit because one of the owners is a traditional sign maker. So she makes signs that are vintage. So they love the 1700s. They love their house. So they kept it all in that period. Other houses I went to, I went to a lot of historic houses. Mark Twain, like you said, Hillstead Museum, Lockwood Matthews, Phelps Hathaway, and everybody did the same thing. They tried to maintain the tradition of the decorations that the house was originally built to. So, for example, in the Phelps Hathaway house, they had the benefit of using Julie Harrison, who is a wonderful horticulturist and floral designer. So she, you know, did a lot of research on the house and found some, you know, old cigar boxes that she could use under the tree, for example, instead of presents, because that area in Sussville where the house is known for their tobacco fields and barns that you see that are still there and their connection to that industry. On one of the colonial hearths, she used sprigs of winterberry and yarrow, which is set against rustic wood and pewter plates. She did roping around a hearth, another hearth in the house, with Douglas fir and white cedar. And, you know, she just kept it. Everything she used was alive and organic, and just that house was absolutely beautiful. Lockwood Matthews Mansion in Norwalk, that's 1865. They have this grand staircase that you'll appreciate this. It was designed by the Herta brothers, and it's black walnut. It's inlaid. It's just stunning, and it's, you know, hand-carved. And with that, they put a bunch of flowers and ribbons. There were some designers as well going up the staircase, and you look up, and there's a huge tree at the top. So everybody really tried to keep within the period that the house was built in, which was really, really nice, because I love history. So for me, it was great to go into all these historic places and see what it might have looked like during the time period if you were invited to one of those families' homes back in the day.
I was really impressed with two things. Number one, the historicism that you talk about, the fact that there were period decorations, not just decorations, but they seemed to me to be, again, extremely ornate and fully formed. But I also was interested in that they're also living humans in many of the pictures, like contemporary people in Santa hats talking to kids. And it seemed like there was an attempt to at least begin to touch on the contemporary along with these almost images from the past that you capture in your photography. Was that your intention, was to make a living document, or did you really want to have a portal into the past, or both?
I don't think I really, the book developed very organically, so I can't say I went in with a set intention. I usually would get onto a location and just look around and start composing and watch and wait to see what happened. I don't recall off the top of my head seeing Santa Claus in the houses I just talked about, but again, my book's 224 pages, and I'm embarrassed to say I did not memorize it.
No, of course not. Well, I have the same publisher, by the way, and I've been giving book talks like you, and I do find the fact that I feel embarrassed by the fact that I don't have my book memorized, but so be it. The one thing I would ask you, though, is I'm looking at this, and I perceive, and I could be wrong, that this is your very first book.
It is. It is.
And do you have other books that you think might be coming to pass based on your photography?
I hope so.
What are you thinking
of
photographing?
Ideas. Sorry?
What are you thinking of photographing? What do you think might actually be?
I have
part of
another
it?
Idea for a book, which I don't want to say too much about,
no.
But it would be working in conjunction with this woman, Julie Harrison, one of those designers. I also have another travel book in mind. This is Connecticut Christmas. It does have a guide in the back, so it is actually considered a travel book. And I have a couple of others, and I am going to sit down after the first of the year and start some book proposals and see where I can go with that. And another one is related to houses again.
How do you perceive your own holiday time? Do you actually create these incredible places, or like the cobbler, do you have a very sparse and elusive Christmas, not a fully decorous one?
You know, this is a little embarrassing. I really don't decorate. I love stockings by the fireplace.
Right.
And we have some lights around that. We have a 9-foot Norfolk pine in our house. It's a house plant, but it thinks it's a tree and it's grown to 9 feet. So if we feel the need, we decorate that. But I much more enjoy driving around and looking at the night lights. I love that. I like other people's decorations.
So you're a voyeur.
Yes, I am. I'm a voyeur. That's right.
Richard is thumbing through your book. Richard, is there any image there that really strikes your fancy that she might be able to give you some insight on? Because the images range, by the way, everyone, from exteriors that are kind of poignant and distant to interiors that are glowing, then also to objects and very small detail oriented things. Richard, you're looking now. I see it at an interesting portal into a house.
I'm looking at page 60. I don't know if you have your book in front of you, but
I was using it as a cheat sheet.
Uh-huh. Well, I am too. So Stonington, is the door on the right the inn? Maybe the inn at Stonington on Water Street?
No, none of those are the inn. Those were doors I found driving on Main Street and Water Street. And it was Christmas Eve day, and all the shops were closed, and there were no cars on the street, which I was very lucky because I don't like cars in my photographs.
Yep.
So I was able to get unobstructed views.
Well, they're wonderful. I spent last Christmas in Stonington, so if you did see
if you
did see a car, it might have been mine. But it's a it's a picture perfect place for
for the holidays. We have a beautiful state.
Yep.
I do think you were able to capture in this in this book a moment of maybe it's even unintended, but it's a moment of human celebration, which you could say is linked to New England and maybe Connecticut in particular. But there is this sense of hopefulness and extreme positive, festive icon celebration and creation. In having written this book, do you have any better sense of the history of Connecticut, or does it just seem to you to be right now and ephemeral, or do you think there's actually, are people trying to get to the past when they create these tableaus?
I think they are. You know, when you go through Litchfield or Stonington or Essex or Noank or even Chester, I mean, one of the reasons I live in Chester, one of the reasons people love it here is because of the way the village looks. We have all these antique villages. I think that people thirst for, you know, a simpler life in some way. I mean, we do have the benefit of technology and the internet, and we move at the speed of light. But I think that people really do love this time of year, like you were saying, where you kind of have a month, a guilt-free month of not having to get too much work done, be with family, walk down a quiet road where there's not a lot of cars because people aren't, you know, out and about, they're tucked in. I mean, I think that we definitely long for that. At least I do.
Well, Karen B. Davis, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. Karen B. Davis's book is A Connecticut Christmas by Glo Pequot. It's well over 200 pages, well over 400 photographs. Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you so much, and happy holidays.
Happy holidays.
Take care. Bye.
So, Richard, I'm thinking about this, and I'm thinking about looking at this book with all these different ways of dealing with things, and I'm thinking about my own Christmas tree, and I say mine. That's really bad because, in truth, it's our own Christmas tree.
You have an amazing tree.
Well,
every year
it's strange though, because the truth is it's evolved, and it's evolved because our family has evolved. I used to take care of everything when my children were little because my wife was cooking like crazy and taking care of the kids. And I would, of course, get the tree and help put it up. And it was that level of stress. But then my second son happened to have the genetic defect of being a football player, which I share with him, which is a fatal flaw. But it's one that he and I have both learned to live with, and we're both past our playing days. But he, unlike me, is in extreme physical shape. And that means that he is exceptionally strong, as he was an all-conference lineman in college. And because of his enormous strength, he was able to help kill and transport and then erect these gigantic trees. And I, from time to time, am an architect who is convicted by my clients to create places where trees will ultimately be harbored, meaning tall places for tall trees. There was one client who said she had a habit of having 9 Christmas trees in her house. Tell us about the sequencing of the Christmas trees in your life.
Well, as I said, I've tended to try to keep a pretty serious Advent. So Advent is the 4 Sundays before Christmas, and it's truncated this year because the 4th Sunday of Advent is on Christmas. But but we start with an Advent wreath, which we have at home, and it has 4 candles, and we light 1 for each Sunday. That's a practice that comes from church, but is just as easily translated into the domestic sphere too. So growing up in Pennsylvania, we got a tree a bit earlier in the month, but still decorated it on Christmas Eve. As an adult and as a father, I've wanted to really create a strong sense of the passage of liturgical seasons for my daughters. They're
interesting.
They're almost 4 and now 6, and so some of that is singing at home. We actually have our own family Advent,
look at that.
Advent songs list.
Wow.
And it's simple songs. It's Come thou long expected Jesus, and people look east, and O come Emmanuel. And it makes for a really nice transition from dinner time to bedtime. And kids love lighting candles, and so that's a really fun practice for them that I hope is forming some strong early memories.
My wife and I, Liz, don't go to that many parties. Don't, it's not really part of what we have vectored towards in our antique years. But the truth of the matter is we do go to one party every year that's in New York City. And it's what I would call a wonderful gathering of very different people because it's New York. And it's in one of these old apartment buildings with 14-foot ceilings. They have a 12-foot tree. The tree is the center of everything. But it actually is interesting in that it's not a Christian place. I don't get the sense that there is any religiosity or Advent aspect to anything there. In fact, the vast majority of people there are not of any kind of religion you can imagine. They're just humans. But the singing of the carols around a piano and a professional piano player, having lubricated themselves with enough ethanol, no eggnog, but some form of ethanol, people sing. And actually, a woman who used to be the editor of Cosmopolitan magazine, who was there with us, was called to come because she wasn't there and she had a good voice. And we have kind of a setup where there are 10 of us that can sing and know the carols. We're all singing. And next to me is essentially an Orthodox Jew who loves singing Christmas carols and talking about the Lord, our Savior, Jesus Christ, and Silent Night and the whole thing. And I realized at that moment that in this home that was decorated with this gigantic tree, that essentially Advent and solstice and Yule all have this quality of human connection.
Sure, sure.
Which is almost the reason we have homes and not caves.
Mm. Well, there's a universality of the joy that people experience in a setting like that. That's a very New York story, and I've seen the same thing with my own two eyes. The Yale Club has a magnificent ceiling, as you know, on the lounge on the second floor, and they put up a tree every year, very nicely decorated. And a fair number of fairly secular people come every year to the caroling party, and it's standing room only, and people have tears in their eyes by the end of the night because it's so comfortable, it's so powerfully sort of redolent with memories of childhood and the carols. There's just nothing better.
Nothing better than the carols. The other thing which is interesting, you're thinking about the sound and the music, people use their stereo systems at the holidays that normally never use their stereo systems. Mm. People use their fireplaces that never use their fireplaces. And then what's happened in the American culture anyway is this very strange thing where this holiday time, this Festivus, Eid, Advent time has bled over into this weird, maybe it's religion, maybe it's not, but NFL time and college football time where people actually worship at the foot of their now gigantic television sets, where there is now a huge devotional, almost worship at the altar of the glowing screen, which almost never happens at any other time of the year. And that has to have something to do with two things, I think. It has to do with the fact the technology has progressed where the screens are huge and not so expensive you can't own them. But also the people have decided they will dedicate whole rooms, and not just rooms, areas of their homes to worship the screen. Before the screens got so big, kitchens were becoming the hearth of the house. And before that, the hearths were the hearths of the house. Now, it seems to me, correct me if I'm wrong, maybe you get a different insight. I sense that the holidays lead into the worship of these flat screen cultural icons.
Is that a good thing or a bad thing?
I think it's horrible. Okay. But but I do think it's interesting how our homes, and the one thing about this show that repeats all the time is homes are more mirrors than directors. Mm. Homes reflect who we are. They don't tell us what to do.
Well, the scenario you're describing puts me in mind of the the TV screen with the logs burning for 24 hours. Have you seen this?
Really?
You can watch.
Oh, the Yule log.
You can watch the fireplace on your TV.
We created in Manhattan as well. In Manhattan, we created an apartment that was actually in the Ghostbusters building. And in the Ghostbusters building, it's a pre-war building done in 1929 before the crash. In fact, they went broke and they didn't sell out all the units there. But they have fireplaces in every single unit. But the fireplaces are just like the fireplaces in the new Yale colleges in New Haven. They're fireplaces in form only. They have no flues.
No chimneys, right?
They have no flues. But in each one, they actually have an electric outlet. Because they would have a plug-in illuminated log, and that would be what they were doing, right? Well, so I'm dealing with the hippest couple in America. They have several residences, and they live mostly in Los Angeles because he's a film producer. So this is at the cutting edge of cool. And he said, and she said, here's the deal. We have to make sure that our TV is possible to move from above the actual above the mantle so that we can put a TV inside the firebox, because he has the ultimate, and he said truthfully, the ultimate Yule log visual, because it has a state of the art soundtrack of holiday music as the log burns. And it's not just a recurring loop of like a 7-minute log burn. Somebody actually had the logs burn for 4 hours so that it's a 4-hour Yule log celebration. So I've never watched the Yule log, but instead I've wrapped presents in front of movies late at night. Have you done that?
You know, I'm not a great present wrapper.
Really?
I'm not. Stockings, sure. I'm great at that, but sometimes my kids get their presents right from my hand.
Wow! So that's I would think
we're saving trees.
They're just old enough now that the box isn't the present. I mean, I remember when kids were little, they would enjoy the box far more than what we gave them.
It's true.
But I think in truth, people discover their homes during the holidays. I really believe that. You know, you buy a house or you build a house and you know the way you live day to day, and then things happen. Birthday parties happen, maybe funerals happen, events happen, and then you're looking at this three-dimensional array of spaces, shapes, and places, and you end up having to reinvent your home for the specific use. And this is the season right now, this week, this is the season where our homes have had the most dramatic and temporal change they have every year. And I think the only thing that I've seen which is similar to this happens far less frequently, and that's the wedding transformation to homes, which I've seen now half a dozen times, where the home becomes the launching of the child away from the home in the form of a wedding. And I think that is actually evidentiary of the fact that at the holidays and people are looking at their homes in different ways, I think our homes can be viewed different ways every week. And I think people do that almost automatically now.
Sure. Well, there's also the dramatic transformation of a domestic space when a child is born.
Huge.
I mean, I remember the first Christmas after my first daughter was born, it was a completely different holiday.
It was.
I mean, you have a child and you're welcoming a child in the same way that the church year prepares us to welcome a child in a very sort of tangible way for the first time. It's just amazing.
I'm right there with you. One of the most beautiful photographs I ever took was of little Will Dickinson, born on September 23rd, on December 24th, looking set under the tree in one of those carriers, mm-hmm. looking up at the tree.
Uh-huh.
And that's also interesting. I think the light levels in homes change.
Yeah.
I think the tree lights or the candles that are used, the fireplaces where if you have all the lights on in the house, the fireplace isn't reed. And I do think fireplaces and trees focus attention to light because the world is so dark.
Well, and there are plenty. This is underscored by the fact that lots of people sleep with their Christmas tree lights on.
Is that true?
It's true.
Well, that's interesting. That's almost a cultural nightlight.
It is.
I guess that's good.
I mean, I've done it.
You have?
Sure.
Well, I also find it very interesting that trees used to be places where they would put ignited candles.
I've never seen that in person.
I actually did see it once, and it's totally terrifying. the tree is bone dry. The needles are falling off, and they put these candles with these clips. They have these clips where there's a clip. It clips onto the branch. There's like a paper, believe it or not, a paper shield, kind of a prophylactic that keeps this burning hot wax from hitting the bone dry needles and igniting the tree in instant death.
Where was that?
That was at a house in Fairfield County at one of those pretentious parties you have when your wife is a second or third year law clerk at a legal institution where people spend inordinate amount of time creating the perfect Christmas trees.
Sure. Are they still alive?
You know, they're dead to me.
Okay.
But I have no idea. But the tree was definitely dead. And what I do find amazing is the fact that we actually physically kill these trees to bring them into our homes where they are more alive than they've ever been in their lives in terms of a human decoration.
Well, not everybody. I there were a few years when I was a kid when we got bald trees.
Okay.
And then you can just plant it in the yard. I mean,
we did that too.
Yeah.
We did that too.
I like that.
When they're little trees. But I got to tell you, if you want to have a big tree, those trees are unbelievably heavy.
Sure, sure.
Even when they're dead.
Sure.
It's incredible. Well, human beings and the holidays, I think, are a special subset of our cultural context. I think what we do every day is so radically different. And I was very struck by the fact that Karen B. Davis, who we talked to, was talking about the fact that people felt they could take time away from work and weren't the holidays so relaxing. I don't know about you, but I find the holidays are the most stressful time of the year, the most exhausting time of the year. I am the most exhausted. We do more cooking. We do more cleaning. We do more throwing away. We do more change during the holidays, which is the one time that is the annualized recreation of a metronome of domestic life in our homes. Because our homes change so much, we feel we should recognize the beauty of our domestic life. Do you think that's true in your life? Are you more split than that and more divided than that?
Well, so I think this is some of the wisdom of Advent. So you get 4 Sundays to get ready. And then if you're keeping it the way I like to keep it, you get 12 days of Christmas.
Which we do too.
Yeah, it's the real 12 days. I mean, your 12th night party is always is always fantastic. But I think some of the stress and some of the accompanying letdown that happened for people on December 26th is that they don't take advantage of the real longer possibility of celebration and the kind of texture of time that gets tacked on after the 25th. And for a lot of people, Christmas ends on the 25th, right. You know, sort of around 3 in the afternoon when people have gone home or everything's been opened or dinner's done or whatever. And then by sort of 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock, Christmas is over, but really it's just getting started. So I don't know. I don't find it quite as stressful as I think you're explaining.
I think in truth, I'm going to back you up on that. We're recording the show before Christmas. The show will be played after Christmas. And I can tell you for a fact that after Christmas, it is one of the most relaxing times, mostly because people stop calling and texting and emailing each other because they're usually too bloated, too tired, too disappointed, or too enthralled with their gifts, their kids, their rituals, and they're also transporting themselves. In fact, I would bet almost anything there are several thousand people listening to this show right now in a car going or coming from someplace during quote-unquote Christmas week, going to grandma, to cousins, to Uncle Fester, to somewhere to actually participate in the social ritual that our homes try to seduce everybody to experience in your house. And I do think there are two types of houses during this time. I do think there are houses which are party houses, social houses, and parties which are chaos I got to get out of here houses. Mm. They never have any parties because they're trashed because they're cooking for other people or they're making presents or wrapping presents. I think the idea that there's a neighborhood that you could walk and peer into people's windows and see Christmas would be, for me, terrifying if they could see the chaos of our homes when we're in the middle of cooking something or wrapping something. It's wildly distinctive at that time. I mean, wildly different. And I do think the expectations before the early 19th and mid 19th century time of publication of the English London-based ritualized Christmas of A Christmas Carol, I do think that time that Bill Hosley was talking about was much more part of our history in terms of the last 2,000 years before that, where there was much more short-term and individually based on the week's schedules, not the year's schedules. I think you would find that true in your study of religious history as well. I mean, the church calendar is broken up into how many different places?
Well, you've got it starts in Advent, actually. So it begins in the winter. And then we have Christmas, then we have Epiphany, then we have Lent, then we have Easter, then we have Pentecost. Right. So you have a different season for different sort of spiritual attitudes and practices. Mm. You have I like to call it a sort of texture of time that and some of this is rooted in pre-Christian celebration.
All of it, yeah.
Well, a lot of it.
Yeah.
But you get the some of the pagan holidays are baptized, as it were, in the church. But we still keep February 2nd, and we still keep November 11th, and we still keep these sort of very very ancient holidays in a new language.
So, thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Duo.
This is an amazing time, and I do really think that what was a weekly celebration to each week's Sabbath can be expanded to each church holiday season, each zone of religious expression. And it's now become this weird time of life and then the holidays leading into the Super Bowl, which is a very strange transition in American culture, a culture that's reflected in our homes, and our homes are reflected in Homepage Radio, which is part of WPKN, one of the great radio stations in America. Please go to the WPKN website to see what they have to offer. And I thank you very much for joining us today on Homepage Radio.